Wednesday morning, 23rd June 1982. Last Saturday, we noted that in the developmental process, in order to emerge out of the less developed, the impure and the imperfect state, into the pure and perfect state, we must die transformatively. This does not mean that the living person's organism must die, because that would just be the end of all transformation. It means that each person must relinquish, renounce, remove all that stands in the way of the purity and perfection of the psychophysical organism and of the mind and the creative spirit embodied in him. In short, of all that produces and maintains the ill state in oneself, and this ill state in oneself is the real seed of all the evil we see in the world. If one is sensible and decent, not stupid and devilish, one would bend all one's energies and use all one's faculties to live the religious life. Religious in the profound and total sense, and not a mere flirtation with the divine on one day and slavery to lust, violence and selfish depravity all the other days. And this religious living will be marked by a steady succession of the deaths of all ill states in thought and feeling, in word and deed. All the world is too much inclined to separate the religious life from the everyday, ordinary, secular life. It is the ordinary, everyday, secular life which has to be transformed into the religious life. And that is something which lies essentially in our power and according to our personal good sense and choice. Ordinarily, whoso dies is buried or cremated. But it is quite different with the innumerable deaths which take place in our lifetime in us. The ill states are unhealthy, defiled, psychical forms which are harmful to us, to our society, to mankind, and sometimes to the whole environment, as for instance if we use nuclear weapons and so forth. These ill states are sustained by our own life energy. When we really see, that is, become clearly perceptive and cognizant of them, they are healed and transmuted into pure, healthy states, and their energy, hitherto destructive, is now constructive. Instead of serving the devil begins to serve us, and in that process he is transformed into an angel. That's what it comes to. The imprisoned creative energy is liberated, and oneself is the happier and healthier for it. Thus, death serves and promotes life. This is a spiritual alchemy. And that spiritual alchemy is something which we ourselves have to perform. In order to recognize what evils obstruct us, we must have some understanding of how we came into being and some vision of the direction in which the human species is moving. Now, throughout the centuries, various ontologies, as we call them, have been presented. And they were suitable for their particular age, their circumstance, and the state of development of mankind. Necessarily, therefore, as the ages pass on, there are changes which take place, and any new outlook in such matters which attempts to plumb the depths must necessarily take account of the changes which are actually present now and use those forms in which to present such fundamental conceptions. Let us therefore, in this modern age, use modern terms. Our source, a unitary whole, is the primordial creative energy which is identical with pure consciousness and with immaterial fundamental substance. Don't think of these three as three separate things. They are one and the same thing. They are identical with each other. Just as if a man's name is Michael John Smith, and each of those names has its own special meaning. As you know, Michael means he who is like the like God. And John is the beloved of God, and so forth. And Smith is a Smith. We all know the Smiths, you see. So, but all three names do not mean that there are three different persons there. They are all the one and the same person. Michael is John, John is Smith, and Michael John Smith are just the one person. It's like that. So we have energy, pure consciousness, and fundamental substance, which is immaterial. This source is self-existent, self-sustaining, self-replenishing. Note how these characteristics are quite different from what we are here as existential human beings. May I suggest, don't merely hear words. Be at ease, still, and quiet. Listen intently and get the deepest possible feel of it in your whole being. This source is infinite and eternal. It is birthless and deathless. These aspects of the unitary whole are in equilibrium, a vibrant restfulness. It is not a static equilibrium. It is vibrant because it is alive. A stir of transcendence starts off the entire process. Some of the Indian philosophies, and I believe in the original Kabbalistic teachings too, you have this idea that the transcendent source, desiring to know itself, created a disturbance which set going the entire universal process through which transcendence comes to know itself. Now do realize that the word know in a transcendent context is entirely different from what knowing means for us. When this process starts, it begins at the invisible transcendent level of pure awareness and being. Energy differentiates and consciousness proliferates, the two intertwining with each other. If you picture the double helix of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, which holds the complete blueprint of all our growth and development as organisms, that is. Or if you like, think of the Ingla, the Ida and the Pingla nadis of yoga, which are intertwined together, going up the third one, the Sushumna. The accomplished yogi and the person gifted with true insight can get the feel of this more easily. We have to bear in mind that it is important to get the feel of it. Don't try to make definite thoughts about it, descriptions. Let the feel of it be nondescript rather than put into very clear, definite words as such. The immaterial fundamental substance, this is the substance which exists before time and space come into being, is our entire observable universe compressed into a pinpoint. It's very, very difficult to see this at all. I mean, our senses tell us that the universe is something tremendous. We know the infinity, the immeasurability of bigness. But we don't take into account, we are not able to take into account the infinity of smallness. And this entire cosmos, actually, at the start of the Big Bang, was the size of a pinpoint, literally the size of a pinpoint. Scientists call the moment when the Big Bang took place the Planck time. It's named after Max Planck, the physicist. That Planck time actually was 10 to the minus 43 of a second after time itself starts. The initial starting point of time is called by these scientists the singularity. And one divided by one with 43 noughts after it, seconds. Rather a short time, isn't it? The Big Bang is supposed to have taken place. Why did it bang? Consider what it was when it was just that pinpoint. The temperature at the Planck time is estimated to have been at 10 to the power 31 degrees Kelvin. Well, practically, you may say centigrade, because the Kelvin scale starts at 273 degrees below north centigrade. Well, 273 is completely negligible compared with 10 to the power 31. Rather hot. Perhaps the 18th half-mum actors got their idea from this sort of knowledge. The density of the universe at that time, in that pinpoint, remember, was 10 to the power 90 kilograms per cubic centimeter. 10 to the power 90 kilograms per cubic centimeter. It's absolutely unimaginable. The ordinary atmospheric pressure which we sustain on our own bodies is 14 pounds per square inch. That is all. 14 little pounds per square inch. And a kilogram is 2.2 pounds. 10 to the power 90 kilograms, one with 90 noughts after it, per cubic centimeter. That was the pressure held up within this, held in imprisoned within this pinpoint. I make a fist, but that is infinitely larger than a pinpoint. One second after the Big Bang, the density suddenly dropped down to 10 kilograms per cc. Now that's not very much, comparatively. That's only 22 pounds per cubic centimeter. From 10 to the power 90, it suddenly drops with this Big Bang. So now you see why the expansion took place. This immense temperature and this immense pressure, and the whole thing burst open, just like that. At least that is what the scientists say. And before long, the average temperature of interstellar space dropped from 10 to the power 31 degrees to 3 degrees Kelvin. That is minus 270 centigrade. And the present temperature of interstellar space is minus 270 centigrade. That's why you have to wrap up well when you go out into interstellar space. This temperature, the present prevailing temperature, is the temperature of about 20,000 million years after the Big Bang. The Big Bang brought into existence simultaneously time and space and matter as we know it. When I say matter, don't think of it as solid and liquid or even gaseous. It is in the state of free protons, electrons, and all the other different ions that exist, you see, throughout the universe. This vast time range has mostly been occupied, that is the 20,000 million years, has been occupied by the involutionary process in which there has been a steadily increasing concretization, that is, became more and more materialized, and both energy and consciousness have become imprisoned in and limited by grosser and grosser forms, till they reached their densest materiality in solid earth, especially in the mineral kingdom. Now we must note another point in this connection, which of course scientists don't touch. You can blame me for this statement. We think of infinity or eternity or God or transcendence or whatever you like as something other than us. Something which is a vast container holding innumerable particulars. That is one of the, I think, this is my own view, I think it is one of the great mistakes which all ontologists and theologians have made through the centuries. I present it this way. The whole of infinity, all of eternity, is embodied in and completely operates through each and every particular, from an atom to a galaxy, from a virus to the perfected Holy One. Each and everything, small or big, as we experience it, has the whole of infinity and the whole of eternity acting embodied there. When I say acting, don't think of it as functioning positively in the way we regard positive thinking. It is there as a potentiality. The totality is held in potentiality in every single particular. I think Zen does imply this when it talks of the interdiffusion of the particular with the totality, with the whole. But if we look at it this way, this I'm just putting it in modern terms. perhaps they are just pseudo-scientific terms, but we can get the feel of this. And if we can appreciate that, it will effect a tremendous transformation of our particular mode of awareness of existence. And in that transformation, our whole life of thought and feeling, speech and action undergoes a change. Thereafter, the liberating process starts. After this densification right down to the mineral state has been realized, this time there is a stir of aspiration to fruition and freedom in earth itself, a stir which is the complementary counterpart of the stir of transcendence which led to the burial of transcendence in matter. This burial of transcendence in matter is symbolized in the cross of matter. There are two equal things at right angles like that, you see. The cross of matter. The Christian cross, which is like this. This thing goes higher up, you see. That's the Christian cross. That cross symbolizes the redemption of man by transcendence through man. So that man, whilst alive, realizes, that is, makes real, the divinity embodied in him. This is the meaning of moksha, or liberation of the Hindu, the Garudamana of the Zarathustrian, the Nirvana of the Buddhist and the Jain, the union with God of the Christian. This stir of aspiration to the transcendent shows in varying degrees of beauty and perfection throughout the manifested universe. In the starry heavens, the earth, the storms and peace over land and sea, in lustrous gems, trees and flowers, in birds and beasts and all creatures, and man himself. We may feel a bit dubious about the last item, but nevertheless that is the fact. But in very truth, in every single human being lies hidden the divine potential, transcendence itself. It is man's privilege to be free to choose which path he will tread. It is his duty to choose it and to let that divine potential come to fruition so that transcendence realizes itself as man in perfection through you, the mortal existential being. Man can choose to do that, or he can choose to thwart that fulfillment through his own stupidity or weakness of soul, that is, lack of virtue. Virtue means the strength of the soul, the strength of the psyche which has become utterly pure. Or through deliberate wickedness, often initiated by the misfortune of evil companions, or congenital physical disease, or incurable abnormality, or never having spiritual food presented to him. Such thwarting is sin. The meaning of sin, and the wages of sin is death. Death in a deep, unhappy sense, and not merely natural bodily death which comes to everyone, be he sinner or saint. Recall what was said a little earlier. Energy differentiates and consciousness proliferates, the two intertwining with each other. Thereby, several archetypal powers functioning at a cosmic level, invisible and immaterial, come into being. In earlier centuries, those who experienced this kind of thing, who were sensitive to it, had no option but to present them as archangels and angels and so on. The various archangels represent are expressions of the archetypal forms of this energy, intertwined energy and consciousness, which come into being and which operate on a universal scale, not on a individual separate scale as such. One of these divine powers is what we call pure mind, which, interacting with the body, produces psyche, your own psyche, whose activities are specifically characteristic of you, the particular person. We have constantly used the phrase "my mind" through the centuries. There's no such thing as my mind. You might as well talk of my space or my infinity. You can't. My psyche is an accurate term, because all our particular characteristics and our what we call our mental processes, thought and feeling, emotions and all the rest of it, they are due to the fact that the brain, the ductless glands and the bloodstream are the material roots, and the body generally is the soil of the psyche and of our psychical life of thought, feeling, mood, and our intellectual and emotional states. I think it is rather important to consider this particular type of presentation. Because to say my psyche is just as true as saying my elbow or my head or my finger or something like that. It is specifically your own mental manifestation. Mind is universal. It is characterless. But all psychical functions and manifestations have their particular characteristics, which means that there has been the analytical breakup of the characterless universal mind as such. You get it? So that is why that is your psyche. Psyche is the right word. It's no good saying my mind. You may note that this is something quite different from the Buddhist presentation. The Buddha and all those teachers of the past, they never used the word psyche. They always used the word mind. Everything was mind as such. But mind is universal. You will see that all the energies of nature, electrical, chemical, heat, light, and so on, are intimately involved with our organism, which is so definitely, therefore, a psychophysical organism. Psyche is personal, one's own psyche. Mind is universal, essentially divine. What is called the thought in the mind of God is the logos, the creative word which brings forth the cosmos. Mind is that ordering, formative power which enables a cosmos with its particular laws and modes of functioning involved in it all. But the mind of God, as the term was used in ancient days, is the logos, the creative word which brings forth the cosmos, and which is also the Son of God, alone begotten, because no concupiscence is involved in divine creation. You see, if you can sort of get the feel of this characterless, remember that's the important point, characterless universal energy which has this formative power, and that is mind. So you see, if you think of the primordial energy, or if you like to use the usual theistic term, God, in divine creation as such, God just minded thus and thus, and all these things came forth in consequence. There's no concupiscence involved in it. There is no other involved in it. It is an extraordinary thing. I mean, I use words, and of course the difficulty with words is that, well, you know what the difficulty with words is. But if you can once get the feel of it, if something inside you, in your innermost consciousness, thrills to it, you will experience it, even in a limited degree, but that will be sufficient to effect a transformation of your mode of consciousness. You or I do not have a mind, only psyche, the hermaphroditic progeny of mind-body interaction. I say hermaphroditic for this reason, that the psyche in us, the whole psychophysical organism in fact, is dual. The male body has its female aspects. The female body has its male aspects. Because the human body has evolved through many millions of years, and the human brain carries the influences of this evolution in its R-complex, its mammalian and reptilian portions of those animal features, the psyche of man suffers some ills. People have often asked, how is it that we have the devil in us? Well, this is how we have evolved. We have come through this animal development. The reptilian stage was followed by the mammalian stage, and that was followed by the development of the cortex. So we have all these characteristics in us. The psyche is ambivalent, aggressive, fearful, moody, confused, conflicting, and contrary. It is dominated in the undeveloped man by the fundamental natural drives for the preservation of the self and of the species, in concrete terms, by food and sex. These are the root sources of his man's pleasure drive, his self-orientation, self-assertiveness, and his ruthlessness. No animal can be so deliberately bestial, predatory, and destructive as man. This is because the cortex, which was the latest to develop, you remember we spoke about this in the previous talk on Monday. All these different aspects in us. And we have all these simply because our whole brain has the traces of all these influences operating inside us. If this were the whole description of man, nothing could save him from damnation. But the source from which he flows is transcendence itself, buried deeply in his psyche, his psychophysical organism, and there has been, is now, and ever will be, the quiet omnipotence and omniscience and the peaceful love of transcendence itself, persuading and guiding, but never compelling man to wake up to his true nature and fulfill his divine destiny. Namely, to be the Holy Grail, the nexus, into which and through which transcendence can pour its creative energy to fructify and bless all mankind. The question arises, of course, the thousands of millions of human beings who have been on the globe since the beginning of the human species, how many of them have been able to respond to this? Very few, of course. Then the question is asked, what happens to all the rest? Well, each and every one of us, sinner or saint, whether we have allowed and willingly cooperated with transcendence or whether we have obstructed transcendence, we all die. And when the existential being dies, it's a complete death. This is what man will not accept. He struggles against that idea. He likes to feel that he, the separate personal being, in some way is an immortal, identifiable entity. This has been man's profound error throughout the ages, right up to our own day. I know it's a terrible thing to say. It's that you or I, as self-conscious, separately self-conscious individuals, when the organism dies, die completely. And people ask, well, what is the point of it all? What is the use of it all? Ask transcendence, what is the point of it all? The separate, self-conscious individual who regards himself as a particular identifiable entity cannot answer that question. The totality has no purpose. It is the totality. That's how it is. And it functions this way. And if we are sensible and we understand it all and cooperate with it all selflessly, with no vested interest whatsoever, then we have fulfilled the purpose of our particular existence in the cosmos. We are like the cells of a tree, or if you like, the leaves of a tree. In the autumn, all the leaves fall, but the tree still lives on. The next spring, new leaves come into being, not reincarnations of the old leaves. If we haven't got the strength, the inward strength, the pure mental and the spiritual strength to accept the reality of death in its fullness, we shall never fulfill life. We may deceive ourselves that we do, but we never will. I, Firoz Mehta, as such, when this organism dies, will be absolutely dead. There is no survival of the I am I consciousness. Absolutely none. Consider in this connection what is said in Genesis in the first chapter. And Elohim represents the total, the word represents the total creative process and the life process of the whole universe. That is what the word Elohim represents. It is derived from Ele, the eternal what, and me, the eternal me, the eternal I. It is this eternal what and the eternal I in interaction which releases the entire process as such. And we have the statement, and Elohim said, I prefer to put it, and Elohim minded, because there were no words before the Big Bang, or thoughts, you see. And Elohim minded, let us create man, not make man, otherwise man would be just a block of stone. He's very much a blockhead still in many ways, but still. Elohim minded, let us create man in our own living likeness. Don't say created man in the image, in our image. not image, in our living likeness. So you see, the whole of transcendence is in man, and ultimately in man as a psychophysical being. It is there locked up. And the immanence in us, which is striving to become one with its original source again, is Yahweh, the meaning of Yahweh, Jehovah. That is the God within, if you like to put it that way. And Elohim represents the God without, as some would say. But I say Elohim represents the totality. And Yahweh is the immanence. The whole of Elohim is in us. And by virtue of that, the psychophysical organism is the vessel of Yahweh. And it is Yahweh which produces that persuasive, guiding influence to enable man to wake up to his to the reality of what he is and grow towards that. We also have that other statement. Underneath are the everlasting arms. Where is underneath? Instead of underneath, if we said within, within the individual self are the everlasting arms, we'd be nearer the reality, I should say. Perhaps we can now have a glimpse of the direction in which the human species can move and is moving. The great spiritual teachers of the world were the first fruits of humanity, the living exemplars pointing fingers of light to our human fruition. But we, as a whole race, being what we are, subhuman still, because we are subhuman still, let us consider the obstacles in the way to our development. Now, in the Buddhist texts, in the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, pages 36 and 7, and in the words of the Buddha, and in the words of Sariputta, who says the same thing, of course, which occurs on pages 15 and 16, they present the defilements of the mind, or the evils which have to be eliminated. It's rather a long list. Greed, ill will, covetousness, anger, malevolence, hypocrisy, spite, envy, stinginess, deceit, treachery, obstinacy, impetuosity, arrogance, pride, conceit, indolence. That completes that list. Note the psychological value of putting all this in negative terms. The theistic religions, practically all of them, have tended to put things in positive terms, strive for the good. But how can you strive for that which we do not or really know? We are well aware of the ills in us. And we can be well aware of the ills in us. We do not know what the real good is. Look at the mess that the do-gooders make in the world. Now, it's interesting to see what some of the Upanishads have said, the obstacles in the way. The Yoga Tattva says laziness, idle talk, association with bad characters, dabbling with mantras, indulgence with the opposite sex. Indulgence, not right relationships. Stable and pure relationships is quite a different thing from indulgence. The Tejo Bindu, absence of right inquiry or investigation, laziness. You'll notice that they mention laziness all along the line. Inclination to sense pleasures, absorption in mundane matters, sloth, distraction, impatience, absent-mindedness. The Yoga Kundli Upanishad says, discontinuing practice out of fear of disease. That's an interesting point. When one strives to live the good life, one comes up with many difficulties where one's health is concerned. Health both physically and psychically. Doubt, carelessness, laziness, sleep, sensuality, delusion, lack of perseverance, and failure to attain the truth. Then one gives up. The Amritananda Upanishad, fear, anger, laziness, excessive eating or excessive fasting, excessive sleeping or waking. Now you see, we have to die to all these things. And how is this death brought about whilst we are alive? There is just the one golden road to it. Observation, mindfulness, watchfulness. But what kind of mindfulness and watchfulness? Without criticisms, without condemnation, without approval, and so forth. Just pure observation. And we have to die to all these states as also to our beliefs. True insight displaces blind beliefs. When we are empty of all beliefs, then we become full of faith. We have to die to our memories, for they represent the past, as also to our daydreams of the future. Thus, we are freed from the tyranny of time. Then it becomes possible to live in the immediate here now, which is indispensable for living in communion, and to die to all attachments, possessive greed, and to aversions, and to unity-disrupting hate. Then only true love, with its concomitants of kindliness, tenderness, compassion, and selfless caring for each and everyone, functions freely through us. We must die to our animal heritage. That is one way of looking at it. Our animal heritage is one of fear and aggressiveness, anger and jealousy. What is it that dies? Whatsoever is liable to come into being must of necessity die. It is not self-subsistent. It is not the eternal context. Only the eternal, the infinite, the immeasurable lives forever and ever, you see. So we have to learn to die to all these things. I'd like to put it this way. We must learn to cooperate with death. That is, we have to commit suicide. Now, hold your horses. Don't run away now and commit suicide. What I mean is this. What is the meaning of suicide? Sus in Latin is oneself. And kido, kidere, kill. All right. So, it means a self-killing. That is, for the religious not a killing of the organism, but a killing of selfness by oneself. That's where the sui part comes in. It's a killing of selfness. But there is no such thing as a killing which is an annihilation. Everything comes into being again and again. It's a repetitive process. So this means that it is not killing in the sense of destruction, but killing in the sense of transformation. And you can't transform if you annihilate, if you destroy altogether. So it is this observation process, this samasati, this watch and pray of Jesus, which is the golden key, that constitutes the entire technique of living the religious life and of fulfilling the purpose of one's existence. That's all there is put in that single procedure, this constant watchfulness. We can put it this way, not suicide, but psychocide, a killing of all the defilements. And we must remember that the transformation of the psyche, the utter purification of it, also implies and brings about the transformation of the body. This is something very deep and profound, but literally true. It transforms the body. We have it represented in the idea of transfiguration, and it comes in all the religions of the world, all the main religions. Moses goes up into the Mount of the Lord, that is, enters the profoundest meditative state. That's what it really means. Goes up into the Mount of the Lord and is with the Lord for 40 days and nights. And when he comes down, his face shone. He was transfigured. Jesus was transfigured. Zarathustra is said to have expressed that same transfiguration. And with the Buddha himself says, it takes place at the enlightenment and it takes place at the final passing away. The transfiguration, a complete transfiguration of the entire psychophysical organism. If we could all do that, beauty parlors would be out of commission altogether. Now, we talked of true love with its concomitants of kindliness, tenderness, compassion, and selfless caring for each and everyone, functioning freely through love, through us. Such love is invariably accompanied by wisdom and purity. And this means virtue in the true sense. Because if there is the complete purity and the wisdom and the love, then there is perfect order. The fulfillment of ripta, as put in the Rig Veda, from which our word right, R-I-G-H-T, as well as R-I-T-E, are derived, ripta, the eternal order of things. Such virtue and such dying to all ill states spell the complete emptiness of the psyche. The psyche is then whole, holy, transparent, nothing in it which obstructs the light of transcendence itself. And it is a vessel, therefore, for divine grace. Mind, the supreme order-producing energy in the cosmos, then operates through your pure psyche, a blessing to the world. through the selfless mortal, immortal transcendence can manifest itself. All the glory is unto transcendence. It is not I who attain or achieve. All I've done is to clean the temple. And the dweller in the temple, transcendence itself, comes into its own. He who can be selfless, whose psyche is empty, is the real psychotherapist. All other professional psychotherapists are just sort of beginning to, they are in the kindergarten stage of psychotherapy. Because psychotherapy in the real sense involves that the therapist himself has no obstacles in his psyche to the transcendent truth and reality, which is the transcendent holiness, wholeness, health, perfection.